This is the Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Brian Beathers, CEO and Chairman of the Board of 1-800-CONTACTS, based in Draper, Utah. Most of us have heard of 1-800-CONTACTS. The company began 20 years ago, a time when the world was a very different place. Back then, technology disruption was oftentimes as simple as getting consumers to call an 800 number instead of visiting a physical store. As the company's name implies, 1-800 sells contact lenses, and they sell a lot of them. On a typical day, this firm sells over 200,000 contact lenses, which is why they playfully refer to themselves as the world's largest contact lens store. An important competitive advantage for the company is clearly the great phone number that they own. In fact, I bet I'm not the only person who, when hearing the company's name for the first time, wished they had grabbed that phone number before it had been taken. However, as you're about to hear today, the contact lens space is brutally competitive. The company is thriving, but it has certainly not been as easy as securing a great phone number and watching the orders roll in. Join us this morning as we hear how 1-800-CONTACTS battled from a dream to become the world's largest contact lens store. Brian Beathers, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Doug, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So as we were discussing in the green room ahead of time, you're not the founder of the company, but you've been with the company since 2003. Started off as a chief financial officer, moved up to president, ultimately, currently you're the CEO and chairman of the board. But take us back to 1995, when the two founders started the company. Back then, how did most people buy their contact lenses?
Well, I'll start a couple years before that, actually. John Nichols was an optician and had been working for Bausch & Lomb as a contact lens salesman. And he founded a company, had a phone number, and started selling contact lenses out of California. Jonathan in Utah was at Brigham Young University, didn't have a lot of money, didn't have a car. He decided he wanted to try contact lenses. So he walked over a mile, down a hill, went to the optical store, got his exam, and the doctor said, "Great, you can have your contact lenses in another week." So Jonathan was, "This is a packaged product. Why can't I have it now?" "Well, we don't have it for you now." So he walked back up the hill, and he said, "There's got to be a better way." And he heard an announcement. Linda Carter used to be in a commercial for a competitor about buying contact lenses online or on the phone. He said, "You know, I've got to do that. There's got to be a business model in that." He went back, got his contact lenses, and said, "You know, I could sell contact lenses to people in the dorm room." And so he started selling contact lenses and had a phone number, 1-800-LENS-NOW. It was a pretty good number, and the business was growing. Advertising is hard for contact lenses because only 13% of the population wear contact lenses. So if you advertise on radio or on the television, 87% of the listeners don't wear contact lenses. So you have to be really efficient. So he was reading Popular Mechanics, a favorite magazine, turned to the back of it, and there's some advertisements. He saw an advertisement from John Nichols. He thought, "Wow, that's kind of neat." So he called John up, talked to him, and said, "Could we buy contact lenses together?" And so they started buying contact lenses together, and John Nichols said, "Look, I don't need to be in California. I'll move up to Utah." So he moved up to Utah, and the two of them started the business. When 1-800-CONTACTS really started was when Jonathan sat back and said, "How can we grow this market? If we're going to advertise, we have to have something that people can remember. 1-800-LENS-NOW is a great phone number, but boy, 1-800-CONTACTS would be so much better."
Somebody else already had that number, didn't they?
Somebody had the number. And, you know, if you own a website, it's an actual name, and that's trademark. But phone numbers are a series of numbers, and they can spell different things. And so what you can get is the right to have a phone number, an 800 number, and if you use it, it's your number. And so he called 1-800-CONTACTS and got no answer. So how do you find the owner of a phone number if they won't answer it? Now, the owner didn't want to pay for calls coming in, so he didn't put an answering machine on it. So Jonathan hired a private detective and tracked down the owner and contacted the owner. And the owner said, you know, here he introduced himself. "Hey, I'm a young student. I've got a small business here that I'm starting. I'm interested in your number." He said, "Well, I've tried to sell this to Johnson & Johnson, the number one contact lens seller. I've tried to sell it to Bausch & Lomb. I've tried to sell it to everybody. You seem like a really nice young man. What could you pay for it?" He said, "Well, $500. And so the owner of it, who was a real estate agent in Florida.
I'm assuming Jonathan got laughed at.
He got his $500 offer. But you know what? It also says, you know, don't be afraid to start low. And the response was not six figures, which it might have been if he had started higher, but the ask was $500,000. So bid ask, $500,000. And over months of discussions, they finally agreed on $165,000, seller financed over 5 years with, I think it was $15,000 down.
And it's not a bad deal.
A great deal. Great deal for the seller because no one else had been interested in it. It was sitting there not being used. And Jonathan had an angel investor at the time, Steve Gibson here locally in Utah, who had been terrific and had helped the company grow and a lot of good advice. But he just wasn't comfortable in investing in marketing and acquiring this phone number. And so we, Jonathan at the time, went to a friend of his and asked if he could get the financing to buy the phone number. And his friend is Steve Yockman, who later came on the board. He now works with Yockman Asset Management. He was his roommate. And he said, sure, we'll help you buy the phone number. So they bought the phone number. John and Jonathan did. And John was a little nervous. And he said, boy, this could be the death knell for the company. And so they turned the number on and almost immediately got a phone call. Someone wanted to buy contact lenses. They thought, well, I've seen an advertisement. There must be an 800 number I could call. And so they just called to find out, and Jonathan answered the phone. Before he answered the phone, he turned to John. He said, well, that's the death knell calling. And so he took the call and took an order. And during the course of the day, they had call after call after call. In fact, at one time, they had two calls come in simultaneously. So Jonathan turns over to John and says, John, you ought to answer that one. That's your death knell. So that was the joke. First month, they had $35,000 of revenue. And in 1 month, then, they more than paid for the initial cost of the phone number. And, Jonathan was, in starting his business, was always focused on having an asset that could not be duplicated, that had a competitive advantage. And the phone number, once we had it, it was our asset. And he likes to say that the phone number makes us a lot smarter than we are. And that's true. It does make us seem a lot smarter than we are. But someone had to be smart enough to get the phone number, and that was Jonathan.
Well, the state of Utah is fortunate that a local firm was the one that nabbed it. I've heard Jonathan tell that story.
Yeah.
And he also says that other companies would advertise and consumers would just assume the number to call was 1-800-CONTACT. So you'd actually get a flurry of calls when other people would advertise, which just shows the power of that phone number.
It does. It's the power of the phone number. And Jonathan also acquired the 1-800-CONTACT and the contacts.com domains. We acquired phone numbers for all of our major competitors. Now, you don't use them. You don't want to confuse their trademark. But there are a lot of things that we did to try to protect our business so that we could grow on the strength of advertising. So when Acuvue did commercials, Johnson & Johnson did commercials for Acuvue, our call volume went up because people just called us. The other competitor at the time that was in the space had actually been advertising on TV for over 5 years. And in the course of the first 5 years with that phone number, we grew and more than doubled the revenue that they had and, in fact, acquired them.
You know, I mentioned in the open that it's not as simple as just having a great phone number and watching the orders come in, and we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. But before I get there, I want to share with you in 1995, I also shared in the open the first time I heard of the phone number. I wish I had grabbed it. Yeah. I went to Stanford Business School. My wife, as did my wife, had a classmate that heard that and said, what other 1-800 numbers are there? And he grabbed 1-800-BATTERIES and built a very large company out of that. So we have Jonathan Coons and 1-800-CONTACT and John Nichols to thank for that as well. But let's get to the point that having a great name is not enough. This was a very disruptive thing to do. I mean, it sounds very simplistic looking back 20 years. But at the time, it was very disruptive. It was not welcomed by the contact lens industry. Why is that? I would think they're going to sell more the cheaper the price. Right now, 13% of the people wear contact lenses. You lower the price, maybe more people buy. Why were Bausch and Lomb and the big players not excited about this?
Well, contact lenses are a medical device. You need a prescription to be fit contact lenses, and you need to have the exam once every year. So you need to go into a doctor. Unlike a medical doctor, a doctor of optometry can actually sell what they prescribe. And so when you go in to see a doctor of optometry for your comprehensive eye exam, before you leave the room, they're going to offer to sell you contact lenses. So roughly 70% of the profit of a typical private OD, doctor of optometry, will be made up of sales of glasses and contact lenses. So whenever you're disrupting an industry and a vested interest sees the possibility of losing revenue, they fight back. And the way they would fight back would be they're selling a different contact lens than we are. They're selling an inferior contact lens. They would talk about health claims, that we weren't as healthy or as safe. And so that really started for us to focus on one of the things that we first started with. The slogan is the exact same contact lenses delivered to your door for less than you would pay at your doctor. That spoke to the fact that it was exactly the same product. It was delivered to your home. It was more convenient and it cost less. That allowed us to start advertising, growing our business and growing our revenue, and taking on the changing an industry, which is what, frankly, attracted me to the industry in 2003 and to 1-800-CONTACTS.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Brian Beathers. He is the CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. So the ophthalmologists, the optometrists, were not excited to see 1-800-CONTACTS enter the business. Taking away, you mentioned, 70% of their profit margins. So how were they able to keep consumers from buying contacts directly?
Well, research in the industry shows that generally it's a patient at an optometrist who asks about contact lenses. But the decision on the brand is typically about 85% of the time by the doctor of optometry. So you may say that you want to wear contact lenses, but you don't come in and know which contact lens you want. So the doctor selects the brand. The brand goes on a prescription. Now, I know a medical, when you buy pharmaceuticals, you'll have a brand on your prescription, but there might be a generic that you can get as a substitution. There are no substitutions in the contact lens industry. And so if you're a manufacturer and your brand goes on a prescription, once that brand is on that prescription, the switching costs are so high that the most important to you as a person to you as a supplier is the doctor who makes the decision, not the patient.
So I wear contacts. I have for 30 years, and I can't tell you what brand I wear. Yeah. I go in and like you just described, let the doctor prescribe it. So that was the tie-in between the medical professionals and the manufacturers of the contact lens. So it's a very close relationship. They need one another. So that's how it works in the U.S. How's it work in other developed countries like Europe?
Europe is actually over-the-counter in Germany. So if you wear contact lenses, you don't need to have a prescription. Typically, you'll see they don't have optometrists either in Europe. They have ophthalmologists, which are medical doctors trained in optics, and then you'll have opticians. So you would simply go in and have a refraction done at a store, and if you needed visual correction, you'd have a technician that would be there to help you buy contact lenses. And so they don't tie the comprehensive exam to a prescription. The same is true in China and many parts of Asia. In Japan, Johnson & Johnson will sell contact lenses without a prescription if you want to order online. So it's one of the anomalies of the U.S. We have a regulated environment, and there are times where regulations stand in the way of assisting consumers in lowering cost and improving convenience. And so what Jonathan focused on is back in 1986, a law was passed in the U.S. that required that a prescription be given for glasses. But there was no law that required a prescription be given out for contact lenses. So we were fighting. Jonathan liked to say that we only had two problems when we started, supply and demand. Okay. On the supply side, the manufacturers didn't want to sell to us. And on the demand side, a consumer could not buy from us unless they had a copy of a prescription. And so we had two problems to solve. And, you know, we like to quote the Army Corps of Engineers model from World War II, the difficult we do immediately, the impossible take a little more time. And the other thing that we focus on is persistence, that nothing will pay out long-term like persistence. And so for us, what we did is we set about changing the laws in the United States so that a retailer could find a way to verify a prescription with a prescriber who didn't want to answer a call. And so in the state of California, we got a law passed that basically said, we call as a retailer and they contact us back in 8 hours. And so we were able to get some laws passed in the state. And then in 2003, we got a federal law passed that requires that a prescription be given to every patient freely without the patient asking it. And it also set up a method that we could verify a prescription with a prescriber. So we have 8 hours, we call them, and the prescriber gets back to us, or if they don't, within the 8 hours, we can sell. That really opened up the contact lens industry for online sales and phone sales. And we grew from low single digits in terms of industry penetration to right now we're just under 20% penetration.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Brian Beathers, CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Brian Beathers. He is the CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. Before break, you were talking about a federal law that was passed where consumers can freely get their prescription, and freely means they don't have to ask for it. The medical professional is required to give it to the consumer without asking. Is that correct?
That's correct. But, you know, when you're fighting to change an industry and disrupt, what you'll find is even if there's a federal law, it doesn't mean that the prescriber will adhere to it. Over 50%
of the
time.
There's a federal speed limit, and a lot of people listening to us right now aren't listening to that. This law that you're talking about is called the Fairness to Contact Lens Consumer Act of 2004, I believe, if I've got it right. Yeah. It's a lot of work to pass a federal law. 1-800-CONTACTS had probably the biggest vested interest in seeing this pass. Mm-hmm. How did you guys make that happen?
We focus on starting from a customer and working back. What does a customer want? What would be important? What would help them in life? And a lot of times it could be a lower price. It could be convenience. It's doing something different than the way it's being done. And so what we did is we reached out to consumer groups to get their support and advocacy. We went to California. We got a law passed that allowed verification. Texas then passed a law that required positive verification of a prescription. We ended up having to cancel over 50% of our orders for a year and a half in the state of Texas because the law had two parts to it in the state. One part of the law was that a prescriber had to respond to a retailer when they called to get a copy of a prescription. And the second, you couldn't sell as a retailer until a doctor responded positively. Now, consumers don't have their prescriptions easily at hand, and so often they're looking to us to take care of that problem for them. And that's what we say. You don't worry about it. You call us. We'll call your doctor, and we'll take care of it. But in the case of Texas, over half of our orders were canceled because doctors refused to respond under the state law. And so we took that information. We went to Washington, D.C., and we started lobbying for a federal standard to preempt state laws. And we used the experience in California and Texas to show there was a model that worked well in California and there was a model that didn't work in Texas. So you have to be prepared. And that's why I mentioned persistence. We canceled half of our orders in one of the most populated states in the country. That was a significant hit on our business. Taking care of regulations to address prescription and demand was only one part of the challenge. The other part, as we had Johnson & Johnson, the world's largest seller of contact lenses, refused to sell to us. You know, they were sued by 32 state attorneys general for collusion with the American Optometric Association because they had actively colluded not to sell to online sellers like ourselves. They refused to sell to us. And there was a settlement in that agreement, but we told the attorneys general that Johnson & Johnson wouldn't start selling to us even though they had signed the settlement agreement, and they didn't. And so we decided after that we would sue Johnson & Johnson for violating that settlement, refusing to sell to us. And so that began about 2.5 years of a lawsuit where we were litigating with, at the time, I don't know, I think they were Fortune 70. Yeah, whenever you take on a company of that size, you know, we always say a couple things. One, You have to make sure you can't settle with the other party. You have to make sure that you are right on the principles and the issue. And then that's where persistence comes through. You have to fight. And so we have. We've fought very hard to disrupt the industry, and it still goes on. Even today, doctors, like I said, 50% of the time won't give out a copy of the prescription.
So talking about suing the large manufacturer, in this case Johnson & Johnson, I know you partnered for several years with Walmart. Was Walmart instrumental in helping you get – nobody does supply management better than Walmart. Were they able to provide some muscle to help overcome some of these issues?
We actually found that while Walmart is outstanding in procurement and supply, contact lenses is such a small portion of their business that when we started to do the deal with them, we had better systems in place, better relationships, and lower prices than they did. We solved the problem with Johnson & Johnson in 2002. And the first thing I did when I came to the company is I negotiated the first supply agreement that we had with all of the manufacturers. I was the one that approached Walmart about doing business with Walmart and negotiated the agreement with Walmart. It was an alliance agreement. In fact, one time they came out to visit our operations, and Jonathan patterned, you know, part of our culture and our business after Sam Walton's book and his rules. And, you know, we love those, and there's a lot of commonality between our two businesses. But one of the things that Sam Walton did very effectively is he would go out and he would learn from other companies. And so we had Walmart came to Draper, and they stopped in to see us one time, and they called me, and I'm president, and they, unannounced visit, they said, we want to tour your operation. And so I went into Jonathan. I said, Jonathan, do you want to give Walmart a tour? And he said, they steal everything, Brian. They're going to come in and steal it. And I said, no, they can't steal what we do. What we do exceptionally well is taking care of customers. You know, we like to say that contact lenses are the product that we deliver. Service is what we sell. And so our focus is on customer service. And so my comment is I didn't believe that they could copy what we did by way of service. So several years after that, I asked someone from Walmart who had just taken over the optical business if he would mind returning the favor. And he said, sure. And so we came down, and at the end of that meeting, I just looked at him. I said, have you ever thought about doing business with a company like ours? And he looked at me and says, no, I haven't. So I was traveling in Europe about a month later. In the middle of the night, I get a call from him. He said, what did you mean? And I said, I didn't have a plan. I was simply asking if you had interest, because if there's an interest, I believe there's a way to solve any of business problems that you have. And so that began negotiations between our two companies, which culminated. We went private in 2007, and then early 2008, we announced the alliance agreement. It helped both of our companies grow. It was a great agreement. They had the option to buy us. At the end of 5 years, they were far more focused on their store growth than they were optical, and so they chose not to exercise it, and we had negotiated a right to either make the agreement evergreen, so it would continue indefinitely, or separate. And so we chose to separate in 2012. So that's just some of the history, but working with Walmart was a great experience. Both of our companies benefited from it, and we were able to separate from Walmart and thrive. That doesn't happen very often, so we're very happy about that.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Brian Beathers. He is the CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. You mentioned Walmart had the option to buy you guys at the end of the term. There's been a lot of transactions for 1-800-CONTACTS. Now, I work in the investment field, and so I have followed, and 1-800-CONTACTS is in our backyard. Literally, it used to be in my backyard when I lived in Draper. Lived at South Mountain and could look down the hill and see your corporate headquarters. So I've kind of followed you guys from a distance, and there's been a lot of transactions. As we mentioned at the beginning of the show, the company was founded in 1995. 3 years later, you guys went IPO, 1998. You raised $27.5 million, and if my math is right, that gave the company a valuation of about $150 million. This was before your time, but obviously you knew you worked with the founders for a long time. What was their motivation for going public?
I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, you get to a certain size and you have members of your management team that may not share in the equity of the company. So going public is a great way to gain a level of liquidity that allows you to reward your management team, who, as you grow, become increasingly important to your success. As an entrepreneur, you reach out and touch most of the associates, but when you start getting to 100 and 200 and then 300 or 500, it becomes more challenging. And so for the two of them, that was part of the motivation. I think for any entrepreneur, you also need to think in the future, what is my exit? You know, what's my strategy? And having a public stock allows you to manage down and, you know, if you will, capitalize on some of the value that you've created over time without necessarily losing the ability to be the leader in that company. So I worked for Marriott Corporation right out of graduate school. And while the Marriott family does not own a controlling interest in it, Bill Marriott Jr., who I got to know while I was there, really was the lead investor in that business and was able to continue to grow the business at a scale that he couldn't have done had he kept it as a family company.
And for a company of Marriott size, it makes a ton of sense. In 1998 was just when the internet was taking off. Companies were going IPO. Great outcomes, at least in the short period of time there before the internet companies I'm speaking of. It was also before Sarbanes-Oxley, when things got where it wasn't as much fun to be a publicly held company. Now, you came on board in 2003. It was still publicly held at the time. Not fun being a public company at the time. And you were CFO, so a lot of that responsibility fell to your shoulders. What did you see? You mentioned some of the advantages of being public. Ultimately, you guys went private, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But what were the disadvantages of being public? Why did getting acquired and going private sound attractive as well?
Just a little, if I can digress on my background. I joined Marriott Corporation in a corporate finance function and ultimately ended up in a business unit that was focusing on airport and toll road concessions.
Now, that sounds like a great business.
It was, you know, we were the first licensee of Starbucks coffee. We brought Starbucks to all the airports in the United States. We licensed over 150 different brands that we brought to the airports. We had 60% market share.
Whether people went to McDonald's or Taco Bell, Marriott got a small piece of that transaction.
Exactly. We were the largest franchisee out there among the different networks. But one of the things that we found is that Marriott Corporation split into two. And Host Marriott Corporation owned the hotels, and Marriott International then managed the hotels. We were the Host Marriott operating group. We went with Host Marriott Corporation. We could help them fund their debt. So we were spun out and became a part of this company that really didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, hotel ownership on one side and operating with 20,000 people, restaurants and gift shops and airports and toll roads around the United States and the world. So about 2 years later, we went public. And so I was a CFO and led the listing on the New York Stock Exchange. So I went through a process to get the capital structure in place, raise the debt, go public. And during that time, I became very versed in what it was like to be public. We had hedge funds that came into our investment. And as a company that operates on the airports, it means that if airport traffic goes down, your sales go down. There's not a lot you can do. And if you have hedge funds that are arguing about your decisions and what you're doing, you can't talk to them about the inside baseball because that's insider trading, obviously. And so you might be doing the things that they want you to do, but you can't sit down and talk to them and tell them, hey, this is what I'm doing. And so we found ourselves with some investors that were upset, but we were doing the things that they wanted. And over time, we eventually sold the business in a strategic sale. And so as a public company, one of the challenges that you have is you move from being the entrepreneurial decision maker, where you have an investor who you talk with one person or a small group if it's private equity owned, and you get the perspective of a long-term investor. You don't have a short-term focus. You're focused on growing. And I spent time in Japan, and the Japanese look at the long-term. And the long-term for them is not a decade. It's longer than that. In the U.S., if you're public, you can be looking at a quarter. So you have to ask yourself, what's my public profile?
A quarter is short term.
A quarter is short term.
Japanese private equity firms, very long term focused.
Yeah.
U.S. private equity firms, not so long term focused. You guys went private. A firm called Fenway took you guys private. I mentioned that you went public at about $150 million valuation. Fenway takes you private. It's about a $350 million valuation. And 5 years later, which in an investor world, that's somewhat long-term, not really by, certainly by an operator standard. You guys were sold to, again, very profitably to Anthem Wellpoint, this time for just under $1 billion. So Fenway did very, very well in that transaction. That's a lot of disruption for the team, though, to go through these different management changes. Were both of those companies pretty hands-off, or were there some big directional changes for the company that often comes with a private equity transaction?
You know, if you're selling a public company, you have to maximize value for your shareholders. So while you may interview and talk with a number of private equity firms and strategic players, you don't select the winner. I mean, if the winner comes at a much higher price, then that's the party you go with. And so Fenway, fortunately for us, the principals at Fenway I had interviewed with previously for another job, so I knew them. I knew a little bit about the firm. And one of the things I did, frankly, is when I was in New York, I was coming back from a meeting with them, and I asked the driver they had arranged that took their people around, and I asked him about the company. And he said, you know, in New York, they're some of the best people that I take around in a car. And I thought, you know, if somebody treats a driver well, or if somebody treats a service provider well, those are good people. And so that's what we found with Fenway. We were fortunate. When you're in a sell process, you want to tell people what you can do and how you can go about doing it. And, you know, if you could get someone you really like to pay the highest price, that's a win for everybody. And that's what happened with Fenway. They spent enough time to understand the company and our potential. Our shareholders had a premium, so they got out of the stock for a gain at the time the transaction was announced. Fenway stepped in, and what you said about disruption is real. Since I've been with the company, we've had four transactions. So I've led four transactions in that period of time.
Which is a lot. You've been with the company 13 years?
13 years. And
that's a lot.
I had taken a company public. I sold the same company. I registered another company to go public, and I sold that business. So I had done this a number of times myself. And that's also, I think, for an entrepreneur, one of the things that you look for in your management team is complementary skills. So I joined as CFO, and 6 months later, Jonathan made me president because he valued the things that I brought. And some of the things that I brought was knowledge of the capital market, the investment community, and selling a business. So we worked very well together. And one of the areas that I focus on is the management. And, you know, when I talk about management, I talk about every employee that we have. And we start with the customer and work back to design our business. But we start with the associate, the employee, to work forward to how we deliver the service. So happy employees are going to deliver terrific service and make happy customers. 80% of our revenue is repeat revenue. So we need to keep customers coming back to us. And every customer that comes to us is going to have to go back to a competitor, a doctor, to get an exam and can buy contacts from them. So that focus really put us on trying to deliver exceptional service. And so my responsibility from day one has been to build the institution, take the culture that we have and make sure that it survives growth, and make sure that we can sustain the business to expand and allow an entrepreneur to retire, because that's going to happen at some point. And what you don't want to have is I likened it to Jonathan created an entrepreneurial book, and he's changing an industry, but the story's not done. And so when he retired, he wants to leave the company in the hands of a management team that will accomplish his goal and objective. And that's what's important to us, is to continue and build on the legacy. And so in spite of transactions occurring, my focus has been in all of those situations to focus the team on what we do exceptionally well, which is take care of the customer. And if we take care of the customer, our performance will be outstanding and our shareholders will allow us to do what we need to do.
If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Brian Beathers. He's the CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. I think it speaks very highly of you and your management team that you could navigate four transactions in 13 years. Very difficult to do. And your company is still focused, is still doing well. That's what investors do. They sell when they can make a profit. That's the game that we're in. And unfortunately, sometimes the flip side of that is true as well. When it looks like, hey, this is not the challenge for this private equity group, then they exit. And the reality is, most investment holding periods are probably much shorter than operating executives would like it to be. And again, it's a compliment that you've stayed with the company 13 years through that, that the culture stayed intact. You've also were put in a difficult position. You mentioned before talking about the transactions that joined as CFO. Six months later, Jonathan promotes you to president of the company. It can be a very challenging job for a day-to-day leader, which I'm guessing you is the role that you were playing, to lead the company when the founder is still there. Obviously, it went very well because you and Jonathan worked together with those roles for 10 years. Tell us, how were you able to do that successfully?
I think it starts with the entrepreneur wanting to get help. So Jonathan, at the start of the company, did research to find out how great companies came about. So he read Sam Walton's book. He went to entrepreneurial luncheons at Brigham Young University. They had an entrepreneurial class. And so he spent time learning. That's how he met Steve Gibson. Steve came to one of those and he went to him. And, you know, a lot of students didn't even bother showing up to those events. It's typically 1 to 8 students. And sometimes he was the only one there. So he gave his plan to Steve Gibson. So Jonathan had that that ability and humility to accept input from other people. And he also focused, he also used the term we, that we are successful. He seldom used the term I. And so it was about 1-800-CONTACT success. It wasn't about my success or his success. He used to say, I was made the CEO the easiest way possible. I founded the company. Like I was the only person standing. And so he recognized that and accepted input. I came into this situation understanding that this is someone who had certain strengths and certain needs. How do I add complementary skills and deliver value in the areas that he couldn't? And so for the entrepreneur, it's taking the time to understand what you need and then searching to find that match. Then once you've found that match, it's allowing the team to perform or the number two to perform. And, it was so successful for me that I did the same thing about earlier this year. I promoted our chief operating officer to president because I found some of his skills and his background. And this is John Graham joined us and had been with us for some time. And Boston Consulting Group background, a nice fit, complementary skill set, and just a great person to work with. And, we have some values that we've established right from the start, and we work hard to maintain them. And as we look at them, the first one we say is we make her day. And we say her because our customers are 2/3 women. So we start with a customer. It all starts with a customer. So it's we're going to make her day.
Funny you say that. My wife is the one that brought me over to 1-800-CONTACTS because she just loved you guys. And that's, 20 years ago.
And that's been the focus for us. Our net promoter scores, if you're a fan of the net promoter scores, which really talks about, the experience you have with a call center or with a website, have averaged 75%. And this year we're up around 80%. If you track that into the industry, that would put us at the top of all recorded NPS scores anywhere. And that simply says that we have people who are thrilled with us because we take exceptional care of them. Well, the next value is we champion you, which speaks to our employees, we call employees associates. We want you to be successful. And so we are going to mentor you. We're going to coach you. We're going to help you do the best on a call. And we're going to set our structure around a way to help you be successful. And the third value is that...
Let me stop you on associates because it's a point I wanted to talk about, and I think it's as good of a time as any. And that is a lot of your jobs are kind of entry-level jobs or earlier in your career type of jobs. It's a lot of call center jobs. I would guess also some warehousing jobs as well. The type of jobs that have a lot of turnover. So talk about, you mentioned about helping them be successful. It's a tough job working on the phone all day. It's a tough job working in a warehouse. What other things do you do to make it a career for the people that join your team?
It may become a career or may be a stepping stone to another career. So if you champion your associates, you treat them with respect. We allow our associates to earn time off. You know, some companies penalize someone if they're not on time. Well, what if you reward them for being on time? It's a different approach. We had a cafeteria back in 1998. Very few companies in Draper would even consider having a cafeteria, but we had a cafeteria. We give our associates the ability to have a work schedule that they want if they're hourly associates in the call center in particular. If you go to another call center, they're going to give you the graveyard shift when you first start. We, on the other hand, run almost 150 different shifts. We will tailor make our shift for your schedule once you start with us. We have a significant number of associates that work at home. So we're trying to provide associates an opportunity that if they want to be a call center agent and that's what they'd like to do in the different phases of their life, our first call center still works for us, our first call center agent. Colleen started in the house when we had a duplex down in Orem, and Jonathan and John had started together, and she was the first call center hire. She's moved on in her career to become a manager. You know, her husband's career moved ahead a little bit. She wanted to be home with the kids, so she didn't work at all for a while. Then she came back and started working at home, and now she's back working at our headquarters, and she's moved from a call center over into a different position in accounting.
Now, for a startup, it's relatively easy to let people work at home. As you get larger, certainly back in 1995, it was hard to do that.
Yeah.
I know another company that has local roots through their chairman of the board is JetBlue.
Yeah.
They kind of pioneered this whole distributed call center. Were you able to allow call center employees to work at home prior to that technology really being introduced by JetBlue? Or did you guys piggyback at all off of them? Or how, at the scale that you're at now, are you able to let people work from home?
Well, we knew that they were doing it and it was possible. So all it came down to a telephone switch that we put in that gave us the capability back about the time that I first started with the company, about 2005, 2004. We changed our CIO. That's the other thing that happens, by the way, as an entrepreneur, as you're growing. People who help you become successful, who are terrific at scaling an initial company, may not be good at scaling as you get bigger. And so, you know, we continually changed personnel as we grew. People would leave our company, and the thing, a true testament to our company is that when people leave, they go back, they leave having enjoyed the company and the experience. And that's what we want. We want people to be successful. We want them to be alumni that love 1-800-CONTACTS. And so we found that by having agents work at home, using a similar technology to what JetBlue had, we gave people choice. But what we didn't want to do is go JetBlue, which is 90%+ at home, because then you lose your culture a little bit. We wanted to have a call center because 75% of our sales right now are online, 25%, a little less than 25% are on the phone. So you might say, why isn't the heart and soul of your company the web? Well, it is, but it really isn't. The heart and soul of our company is a call center because that is person-to-person voice. You can't see someone. You've got to take care of them based on what they say and how you interact with them. And that's the heart and soul of 1-800-CONTACTS. It's that interaction that we have. And we built that in and wanted to have agents that would stay in our headquarters so that while we have a lot of hourly associates, we have a significant IT department. We have over 110 people in our IT professionals. We've got a marketing department of, you know, 50+ people. We've got a lot of professionals in the company. And so, you know, I would say that we're probably, you know, 50% professional now. So we still have a large call center, but we have a lot of people. And boy, if you've got somebody that's going to school and they love what they do and you have tuition reimbursement, and they come out with a degree, and they have a skill set that you want, you move them into another area. And so turnover, we've always had low turnover for call centers, but even low might mean that you're running 40% turnover. So you—
What's typical? What's the industry standard?
60-80%
wow,
on some call centers because they're doing debt collection. Look, our call center is a service center. It's not a call center. It is a— it's an opportunity for people to interact and sell. And so if you're trying to sell, you don't treat a call center as a cost center. You treat it as a profit center. So we've always approached our call center as a profit center.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Brian Beathers. He's the CEO and chairman of 1-800-CONTACTS. You were talking earlier, I asked you about serving alongside with the founder, which can be a very difficult thing to do. You've obviously done that very well. In fact, as I heard you talk about that, I think the person that has done that the best, in my opinion, over the last 20 years is Eric Schmidt at Google. Eric Schmidt also has some Utah roots. Hits on many of the same points that you brought up there. So anybody in that situation, obviously, I think, thank you for sharing your story on that, but also listen to any of the talks Eric Schmidt gives, because he talks about that quite a bit. It's an important issue. You also mentioned after 6 months that you were promoted to president. Now, this is a company that has legal strategy is really important. We spent a fair amount of time earlier talking about legal issues. I've got three or four more current things that are still going on. So it's just your business, surprisingly to me from the outside. If somebody said, what are the main issues in the contact lens distribution business? I would not have put legal as one of the top three, but I certainly should have. So talk to me about how you look at your legal strategy and how you make things happen. I mean, our political system, unfortunately, is broke. We're in the middle of the election season. We're seeing it now. How do you make things happen on the legal front?
Discipline in terms of any battle that you take, make sure that it's worth the fight. First, and second, try to resolve the problem any way possible so you can avoid litigation, because it's costly in time and money. And which is more important, time or money? Because they're both invaluable. So if it's going to take your management team a lot of time to work through litigation, be cautious about it. We are in a regulated industry, and so if you're in a regulated industry, it means that you're also subject to possibly the FTC or the FDA or other bodies that make decisions that impact consumers in terms of health or safety or commercial reasons. And so what I've been surprised at is the difficulty in changing an industry completely. So how would I move to a model that might be different? So a doctor of optometry can claim that if you buy contact lenses from 1-800-CONTACTS, they're inferior, or that you might have health problems. And they're in a white lab coat, and they go to Congress, and they testify and say these things have happened, and people in Congress listen to them. And so it's about being on the right side of the issue. And the right side of the issue, in my opinion, is taking care of consumers and lowering healthcare costs. And that's important.
There's been some very famous legal cases going on in businesses that are disrupting industries. I mean, come to mind Uber and Airbnb. Mm-hmm. Frankly, hearing your story, it sounds like, ironically, your journey's actually been every bit as challenging as theirs. We're here in the state of Utah. Uber was banned. Zenefits was banned, which was they were disrupting the insurance industry. Have the challenges of those industries that have gotten a lot of press, has that made your journey easier or more difficult?
It really hasn't impacted us. I think the journey that we're really starting to embark on in the United States is telemedicine. How do we lower healthcare costs and get better outcomes for individuals? You know, we can talk about Obamacare, we can talk about trying to get everybody covered by insurance, but why don't we talk about lowering the cost and increasing the number of people can then afford it? So on the healthcare side, we haven't even started to see the change that might occur in the next 5-10 years with technology. And we believe that's going to open the door for further changes in the contact lens industry and in vision in general. So if you can buy contact lenses in Germany over the counter, and we've had ophthalmologists that have surveyed all the data and the studies that have been done on a common problem with overwearing contact lenses or not using healthy habits, is called keratitis. It's not that it happens that often, but if it does happen, your eyes are going to get sore and you could go blind. So it doesn't happen very often, and doctors point it out and say, this is the terrible thing that could happen if you buy contact lenses online or if you don't go in for an annual exam.
Is that limited to contact lens wearers, or is everybody susceptible to that?
The principal cause for keratitis is consumers who wear contact lenses overnight and don't trade them out. Don't wash your hands before handling contact lenses. Don't use contact lens solution. They use tap water. Those are some common challenges that may cause it. The single largest cause of keratitis is those types of items. It's not where you buy product. Where you buy product has no impact on keratitis. In fact, the best way to avoid it is to wear your contact lenses the way that your doctor recommends and that retailers recommend. Don't stretch and change your contact lens case, things of that nature. But telemedicine, if it could open up to where an OMD, as an example, could oversee a remote refraction, you might lower the cost of an exam. And if you could lower the cost of an exam, you'd lower the cost of healthcare, and it could open up the marketplace. So there are things that I believe in the next 5 to 10 years that will impact the industry in a meaningful way to lower costs for consumers and increase convenience. And what we find is that our customers are actually more compliant than customers that go to a doctor directly. Because if you have cheaper contact lenses, you buy them at a more affordable price, and they're convenient and easy to get, you're going to wear them consistent with the manufacturer's recommendation. What I did find with some of those other players that are fighting the battle, you know, one battle that we have right now is, it's not something I can really talk at length about, but it's an action by the FTC objecting to some agreements that we have protecting our trademark. The trademark that we have is incredibly important. We've invested over $500 million in advertising to support 1-800-CONTACTS. But when you go to Google and type in 1-800-CONTACTS, you might have a competitor's ad show up under trademark search. So very early on, we went to Google and said, how are we supposed to take care of this? And they basically said, work that out with your competitors. So we did. We went to our competitors and we said, this isn't right. You know, we are not going to advertise on your trademark. Don't advertise on ours. So we had to sue a couple of competitors. And eventually we signed settlement agreements with all of our major competitors. And the FTC has taken issue with that. And so they've now sued us in administrative law court challenging this agreement because they want trademark search to be unfettered. We, on the other hand, believe that when you invest in a trademark or you invest in IP, it should be protected. We're absolutely advocates for change and increasing convenience for consumers, but we also believe that if we advertise and build a brand, someone overseas shouldn't come in and free ride on our trademark and get business. And so those kinds of things happen, I wouldn't say all the time, but they happen occasionally.
And every brand has that issue, right? You'll be glad to know I am aware of the issue as one of the questions I was going to diplomatically bring up. I appreciate you bringing it up ahead of time. I Googled 1-800-CONTACTS ahead of time, and at least on the first page, you're the only company that comes up. Now, easy enough if I want to find a competitor, you just toss in the word competitor in that search, and pages and pages come up. I know that's scheduled to go into litigation early next year, right? So
April of next year.
That's coming up very quickly, which circles me back to the legal issues and just my surprise at the importance of navigating the legal system in your industry. You're a finance guy. When you were promoted to president, oftentimes in an industry like this, the person that would be in that, that would wear the hat of the president, second to the founder, would be an attorney. Why do you think the decision was made? It said, okay, you're not an attorney, but that's okay.
I think in finding talent for any company, you want to focus maybe a little less on experience and more on potential. Get to know the people that you hire and the people that you have to find out what they're capable of. And someone who's gone from multiple industries, someone who's conversant in multiple topics can be an incredibly valuable asset to your business. So Jonathan, as an example, his father was chief legal officer for Texas Instruments. So Jonathan thought about going to law for a background. I was a political science undergraduate, graduated in public policy from Brigham Young University, and was debating, should I go law or should I go business? I opted to go business. In my early years with Marriott Corporation, a lot of times I was working on contracts because, you know, the backbone of a lot of agreements is how you write an agreement and the contract. So the reason we were able to do an alliance with Walmart and not have our hat handed to us is because we structured an agreement that was fair to both parties, and we took enough time and attention on that. And I drove that process. And so while I'm not trained legally, I know when to get help. And that's what a good founder, an entrepreneur will do. That's what Jonathan did, and that's what I do. And so if you've got a great general counsel, you can survive. A lot of times it's finding what is essential for your business to be successful. It's not always apparent. So you wouldn't have thought that legal and lobbying is important to an online or a phone company, but in our instance it is because of the regulatory aspect of what we do. In Marriott Corporation, what attracted me to Marriott is that finance was an important discipline within Marriott Corporation. They had a lot of CFOs that were successful, that had moved on to other companies, and that appealed to me. So marketing was important, but boy, operations is incredibly important with Marriott. And so when you start looking at companies, Procter & Gamble, boy, you better be on the marketing track because that's omnipotent. So, you know, when you look at companies, it's like matching that skill set, not being afraid to allow the team that you have to develop in other areas. And leadership is not about having all of the skills that are necessary for success when you start to scale up. It's about finding the team and the resources that can win. And that's our third value as a company. It's that we win as a team. So, you know, after we talk about, you know, we make her day and we champion you, the third value is we win as a team. That's where the we came in. And you know, our last value is we live for the impossible. And as a company, we changed an industry. We're not completely done, but you know, how many companies can say that we passed a bill through Congress? You know, that's not very often, or that we successfully settled a lawsuit with what is, you know, a Fortune 100 company. I think that speaks to having a team-based approach.
Thank you for that. You know, you were just talking about kind of the long arc of your career, and we've just got time for one or two more questions, and I want to bring it to your personal journey, which you touched on that just then, you know, what you were looking for when you joined the Marriott team. What advice, you went to BYU, you got your undergrad there, you also got your MBA there. What advice would you give to young people? I want to first start with the choice of career, the choice of major. You know, there's a lot of pressure on young people now. There's jobs that seem like if you major in this area or that area, it's easier to get a job, but it may not be what you love. Your undergrad's in public policy. I would argue that it's probably helped you quite a bit as you've navigated some of these issues with legislatures. What advice do you have for young people on choosing a major?
Do something you like. Nothing can substitute for being in a job that you enjoy. You're going to work hard. And success so often depends on the amount of attention and commitment you give, the energy and the passion that you bring to it. And if you're in an industry or a company or a role that does not intrigue you, make a change. A second, don't start out with a career map laid out because the world is not going to happen that way. There are a lot of surprises. There's a lot of luck that goes into it. I never thought we'd go through 4 transactions at 1-800-CONTACTS. I mean, the last 2 Christmases, or the last 3 Christmases, I did 2 transactions over Christmas. So my wife's told me
that's a lousy way to spend
Christmas. Another one. Exactly. And so, yeah, I couldn't have scripted my career. But I think where we're going in the future is that technology is an enabler. A lot of times you look at technology as the end result, but it's enabling something. And so if you're going into a career that's focused on technology, information technology, you're a programmer, you're a developer, if you're going into business, don't lose sight of all those tools, doing something for people, creating something of value. And, you know, I loved Steve Jobs' book and his career. And, you know, my daughter works for Pixar, so I love Creativity Inc. and heard, you know, Ed talk about how we all have creativity. The way that we approach business should be looking at the whole and trying to solve the whole. And anyone can be creative. You know, so don't pigeonhole yourself. Look for the possible, be flexible and adapt and make some changes. And, you know, when it comes down to technology, boy, in 5 years from now, you know, we're going to have solutions that are mind-boggling 5-10 years from now. How are those solutions and that technology can allow you to do things that you may not be a programmer today, but 5-10 years from now, the technology may be such that you don't need to be a programmer to come up with a solution with technology. So I think it's an exciting time, and Utah is a great place for a company to be located. You know, we've enjoyed it. I came to Utah from the Boston area, and I wouldn't have done it if it weren't for a company like 1-800 that was looking to change the industry, not just looking to make money in a short term. And I think the 1-800s today in Utah are far more numerous than they were, 13 years ago. Yeah, so I think for any individual that's coming in or has an interest in business, get out there and start doing some things with some companies. Explore your career.
That's great advice. Good note for us to wrap up on. Brian, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
That's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest this morning has been Brian Beathers. He is the CEO and chairman of the board of 1-800-CONTACTS. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire interview with Brian on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on the Bottom Line.